Okay, we're going to start. A watch pot never boils, and in a retreat, if you wait for everybody to come in, you never get started. So we're going to get started, and everybody will crowd in now because they know somehow mystically that we're starting.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions about the forms that we showed you? It's really nice and convenient now. We only have to bring two forms instead of bringing four of them. And it makes it a lot easier to go over quickly. There are a couple of...
I have a question. The healthcare power of attorney, do not resuscitate order or whatever, you know, all those kind of deals. What is a good recommendation, a desire for natural death? What is a good recommendation for getting those papers in front of the people that... I have two parts of the question. Getting these papers to the people that will be the ones that will communicate on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, and more importantly, that the people for doctors, hospitals, whatever, that they will in fact obey the truth in the papers, mm-hmm. and not blow them off. Because okay. I've heard story after story about them not following and saying, well, we're just going to do it anyway because we don't believe we'll be liable if we don't resuscitate this person.
Right.
That's what I'm really concerned
Let me address that first.
Okay.
That's probably the most
that's
important.
That's really what I meant.
And we talked about the Roman Catholic forms of five wishes. One of the most important things that document lacked was a HIPAA release. And just by the way, these are not just our forms. These forms have been vetted by attorneys, bioethicists, Orthodox theologians. They've been gone over by a lot of people. And our objective was to make them applicable in all 50 states, which turned out to be easier than what I thought it would be. But the HIPAA release is absolutely vital. Father's absolutely right. If you go in with a form in your hand and say, this is what I want, they're going to ignore it unless you release them from all responsibility for anything they do or don't do on your behalf under the direction of your... And the HIPAA release is in there. It's in those forms to release them of liability.
You can take a form to the hospital that you normally go to, mm-hmm. and they will put it with your records.
Yes.
They will ask you to have those.
Yeah, they should ask when someone comes in the hospital. But that's part of what we're here to encourage today. One, the first part of your question, Father, the original of these forms should be with the person who has your power of attorney. And obviously, you're going to ask them to agree to do that. And there's also an alternate power of attorney on this form. You're going to ask that person, if my brother is incapacitated or for some reason can't act as power of attorney, would you do that for me? When we did the first batch of forms and we were working on them, I told my wife, I said, honey, you know, if it comes down to it, I don't want you to have to make these decisions. I think I'm going to name Father John as my power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney. And she says, oh, no. Anybody's pulling the plug on you, it's going to be me. And that's the truth.
I want to mention one thing.
Life and death, right?
Yeah. You know, a lot of times people do their power of attorney and, you know, any funeral plans, and they put it in their safe deposit box. And their family doesn't even see them until after they're buried and everything else. So it's really...
So the original needs to be with the person who has your power of attorney. Copies need to go to the people who need to have them.
Yeah.
Your spouse needs to know where it is. Your children, brothers and sisters, you know, close family members and friends who need to know this information. And we also really advocate, I don't know if anyone has taken up this task because it's more paperwork, it's more trouble. We're all small churches. We really recommend that a copy of this paperwork be in the church, that everyone's paperwork be here, so that if none of those, you know, people are available or whatever, the priest can go in the file and say, okay, here's Mark's paperwork. I'm going to the hospital. I'm going to take it with me. And then you need to, someone should take the responsibility of delivering that paperwork to the hospital. That's another one of the first steps of organizing here that we talk about is talking to the hospital. I don't know. I know we passed one just right down the street, I think, on the way up here. If you have a particular hospital that most of your people are going to go to, talk with them. Talk with the administrator. What are your protocols? This is what we do. What do you need from us to make that task easier for you so that we can coordinate? Communication is everything and anything in life. We need to communicate with them, educate them, and that goes for every step in this process. Yes, ma'am.
Do you know if a digital copy is right. just as good as, because if we could just have a digital file of everybody's paperwork, then it's like if the priest was somewhere, he'd have it on his phone, on his, you know, be accessible instead of him coming all the way either back here.
I want to talk with an attorney about that. I can't advise you on California law.
Anyway, it wouldn't be the original.
I know in my occupation and in most things we're dealing with these days, most states say that an electronic copy is as valid as the original, but the original will always trump. It will always be, you know, if someone shows up with a different original, it will always take precedence. But I would ask an attorney if that's okay. It sounds like it's a great idea.
Make sure there's a real signature on it.
Yeah.
Like a photo of the document that's been wet signed is good.
Yeah. But
don't just type your name.
It wouldn't be the original, but at least then, like, Paul Gatton would be able to bring up, you know, somebody's records and say who it was and contact that person. Mm-hmm. You know, even that, knowing who the power of attorneys are for a certain person
in contact.
Would be helpful information.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that would be a great
thing.
I want to say one thing before we better move on, because you won't have time. Don't forget that financial power of attorney, because, again, a lot of times that's in a safe deposit box. But what if Mark, God forbid, had a stroke tomorrow, couldn't talk, or was in a, you know, something, and I needed money to be able to take care of him, or your parent? You know, you need money to take care of them. Do you have access to that money? If you don't have power of attorney, you don't. One thing that we've done, and it's, I can't recommend it for everybody because you got to really have some trust there. We have each other's power of attorney for everything financial and medical, but we have our money in our kids' names. And not completely, but everything we have has one of our names and one of our children's names. Sometimes a family, you can't always do that or trust them. But if anything happens, they have complete access to the money to take care of us.
They have instant access.
Yeah.
That's an important thing. Yes, Father.
So can you explain the idea of a trust and how does that work?
I can't. You need to talk with an attorney about that.
No,
I don't know anything about trusts and legal issues.
Okay, and does this packet suffice for where we don't have to go meet with a lawyer to work out the paperwork?
It should. I would recommend that someone, if you know a lawyer, I would think in all the churches around here, there's got to be an attorney that goes to one of these churches, an Orthodox attorney, who would be willing to look at it and see if there are any California problems. What I understand and what really makes this thing applicable in all 50 states is it's not so much the wording in the document. You can handwrite a document, but it's something called the formality of signature that differs from state to state. Some states only require a signature and a witness. Some states require a signature and two witnesses. Some states require a signature and a notary. So you'll notice on these, we have the most formal form of signature that you can have, which should cover even those states that only require one signature and a witness. So that's what really makes it applicable in all the states. There are two other forms that you need to, your last will and testament you definitely need to have. Some states differ on how financial estates are handled, but I can only talk from South Carolina because that's what I know. The will is to handle everything that doesn't transfer directly to a survivor. Elizabeth mentioned that we have two people on every account. Every single account always has two people. I don't have anything that's solely in my name. We travel a lot. We love to travel, and we travel together. And a few years back, I got a note from Vanguard that said for some reason she couldn't be my beneficiary anymore in Vanguard. So we thought about it a little bit. We said, okay, how do we handle this? And so we made sure that everything was divided roughly equally between the two of us. One son is the co-owner on my account. The other son is the co-owner on her account. They don't know that. But if they ever need it, they'll find out. And then it will be very good for them. Yeah. My dad taught me this from the time I was very little. Always have two people on every account because you're co-owners. And if one dies, the other immediately takes possession. Yeah. It's their account. It does not go through probate. What probate is, the will covers probate. Anything that does not transfer automatically to another owner goes into probate. And what probate is basically the estate is held by the court. The court puts out a notice that says, Mark Barna has died. If you think he owes you money, come and talk to us. That's what probate is. Mark Barna has died. If he owes you money, come and make a claim at the court. And it can take a long, long time. So it's really, take a look at all of your finances and think about these things and think about who you want to inherit it and can it transfer automatically. As she said, we're really blessed. We have two sons that we trust with our lives and our finances. So.
Yeah. My wife and I have set up a revocable trust, and I think that's what Father was asking.
Yeah.
A revocable trust is you set things up and you have an executor in the trust. And we, while both of us are alive, or either one of us are alive, it's fine because the name of it is our name, but it's a trust. It's not... Our trust owns it, of what we have, not us. So if either one of us goes away, the other one can carry on without a blink. And if we both die, then our son can carry on without a blink. This is the important thing. And in a will, you put in the disposition of your assets as you like. And that, of course...
So that eliminates probate, right?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yes. Both of these things
are the will is governed the things that are in probate when they go to probate. That's what the will is for.
But we found a lawyer in Upland that was recommended to us by Margaret Pint, who's a member of our parish here. He's done very well by us. If you want some information, I'll give it to you on the side. Thanks.
The will is something that needs to be done with care. There are a lot of ins and outs to it. Basically, my attorney, it's also my best friend, and he taught me about these things. You basically have to think about every possible thing that could happen. And I have a generic will if anyone would just like to see it. I'm not saying that it's what you want to use. But we went through that process and thought about, okay, what if Elizabeth dies before I do? Okay, it's my will, so obviously I'm dead. What if she dies before I do? Well, the two sons inherit. What happens if one of the sons dies? What happens if both of the sons predecease me? What happens if one of the sons is divorced and predecease me? You know, you think about this stuff, and it's pretty much in there in this generic copy that I have. It can help you think through it. If you'd like to have it, you can contact me at christianending.com, christianending@yahoo.com, and I'll be happy to send you that generic copy of a will. The other form that Elizabeth mentioned, and I am not telling you to go do this is a durable power of attorney. I'm just mentioning it to you. You can discuss this with your attorney and with your spouse or whatever. If you are in a caregiving position, though, you need this document for the person you're caring for. You need it. Understand that a durable power of attorney gives the person you name total control over your life. The healthcare power of attorney only comes into play if you are incapacitated. A durable power of attorney gives them carte blanche over your finances and everything else having to do with your life. It's a loaded time bomb, and you really need to approach it really carefully and know what you're doing. We've been together over 40 years. We've been married for 39. We think we're pretty safe. You know, I have power of attorney for her. She has it for me. Obviously, if you're our primary caregiver for a parent, brother, sister, loved one, you need their durable power of attorney because you need to be able to make any decisions regarding their mortgage, their real estate, their bank, and all of those things. You need to have access to their money. You need to be able to take care of business, to take care of them. So if you're approaching that, you need to broach that subject with a parent, if that's what you need to do, and get that taken care of. Because the closer you get, and once they're diagnosed with dementia, it becomes much harder to get that document. So just that's important to know. I was told I need to mention that we do have a book. We wrote a book. That's why we're here. Don't write a book. People start thinking you know something when you write a book. It is here. It's available. I know we have some copies left. We have a few up here.
We sold all but two.
Okay, and we have a few more up here. And if you would like for us to sign a copy, we'd be happy to do that while we're here. So that's the advertisement for this afternoon.
Will you be here tomorrow?
Yes, we'll be
at
here.
At this parish?
Yes.
We'll with be here. Books?
And not unless they're all gone, yeah.
Okay,
then
we'll be here.
And we'll take orders. You can take orders. He'll take the orders.
This won't be signed.
So all of this is part of... Y'all came back, so I guess you're still interested in what we're talking about. So we're going to assume that we're actually thinking about doing these things. So, excuse me. How do we organize this? How do we get started? How do you start doing this? I told you this morning that ours was an emergency situation. It just, boom, and we were thrown into it. Fortunately, we had thought about it. I had thought about what will we do if we actually start doing this? And I wrote a list of instructions for us, and that was kind of the genesis for the book. The book is A Christian Ending, a Handbook for Burial in the Ancient Christian Tradition. And it is a handbook. It's step by step by step. How do you deal with the funeral directors? How do you deal with the hospitals? And how do you prepare a body for burial? If you're considering doing this, the last person in the world you want to talk to is a funeral director. If you didn't hear that this morning, I'm going to repeat it. He will lie to your face. You can't believe what they tell you. I'm sorry. I know there must be reputable funeral directors out there. I keep hearing rumors about it. I've just never met one. And the history of their industry is one of abuses that you just really can't believe. That's the last person you want to talk to. The first step, I think, and we agree on this, the first step in organizing is to create a visitation ministry if you don't already have one. That really is the first step. When someone goes in the hospital, people go and visit. They know that someone's in the hospital, they got it. Probably every church that's represented here has someone in that church that just does this. They do it naturally. I know we do. We have two or three of them. Anytime somebody's in the hospital, they're there. That's just what they do. They do it naturally. I'm not that person. But if someone called me and said, hey, so-and-so's in the hospital, would you go see him? Yeah, sure. Okay. So it helps to have a core of people who are willing and able to go visit people in the hospital. The priest may not be able to keep up with everyone. He's got his hands full. And it's very helpful for him to have people who are going to the hospital when he's not there to say, hey, Father, I saw Betsy today and she's not doing well. You know, things like that. To keep him posted on what's going on in case he can't be there. And to talk so that the administration, the nurses, particularly the ones on the floor, know that we're there, know that we care, and know what it is we expect to do. Probably the best way to communicate with them, even though it's not 100% true, is it's just like what the Jews do. They understand that. They understand what the Jewish patient needs in the hospital when they die. And it's something they can relate to. It's not 100% the same thing, but they understand that. And anytime we meet any sort of resistance, as Father mentioned earlier, well, it's just like what the Jews do. You can't deny us the opportunity to do this because we're Christians. Our tradition follows out of the Jewish tradition. They're much more rigid in the way that they do things, and we have a whole lot more flexibility, but it's just like what the Jews do. Having a phone tree is a great thing. You know, we rely on email a lot, and I don't do a lot of email. I mean, I do a lot of email, but it's all at work. When I come home, I don't want to see a computer. Don't want to see it. When I come, I don't have my cell phone with me today. When I come home, my cell phone goes on the charger, goes in the drawer. I know I'm rare, but there are some of us out there who don't want to be tethered to technology. So the old-fashioned phone tree is a good thing to have, even though you won't reach me on my cell phone most of the time. I do answer it when it rings. I just don't check email on it, and I don't check text. If I'm around and it rings, I'll pick it up. Get a kit together. The contents of the kit are also in the book. We've modified a few things. It's a nice thing about being asked to do a second edition. You get to change things and that you've learned over time. When they asked if we wanted to do a second edition, my knee-jerk answer was no. But we talked about it a little bit. Elizabeth said, you know, we have learned a lot in the last 10 years. Maybe we should think about doing this. So I realized that the reason I said no was a very valid reason, because I told the publisher, yeah, it'll probably take a couple of weeks. We'll write a chapter on cremation, and we'll clean up some things and change some things that we've learned. It took 3 months. So it's not easy. The first thing you should have in your kit is a copy of the book. This is the handbook, right? Step-by-step instructions on what to do. We have a cross and an icon in the kit. We have a censer and charcoal and a lighter. We have the New Testament and the Psalms. Surgical gloves, wet wipes, antibacterial cleanser, washcloths and sponges. Sponges for anointing, a plastic base, and shampoo, and the list goes on. And all of this fits in a airline carry-on bag, which is really convenient when they call you and ask you to go bury the Archbishop. You know, it goes on the plane. TSA doesn't quite know how to handle it. So I wrote it has a handwritten note that goes right on the top of everything when the TSA opens it. It says, TSA, This kit is for the preparation of a body for burial. I figure after reading that, they ain't going any further. But at least if they do, they'll understand why there are liquids in there, why there. We have the anointing oil is in there. Just really everything you need to do. And actually, there's everything in there you would need to prepare two bodies, usually. And some things or others. We have diapers in there. All kinds of things. So that's in here. Talk with the people in your church. You know, who's interested in doing this? I can't imagine how you would do this without the support of your priest. So I'm really, really gratified to have so many priests here today. I've had people tell us that we're really interested in this, and I have a small group of people who are really interested in this, but our priest just thinks it's silly, and our priest doesn't want anything to do with it. And I can't, you know, what should we do? What can I tell you? I don't know how anyone would begin this ministry without the wholehearted support of their priest. You're going to probably meet enough resistance from other parishioners that you don't need your priest's resistance as well. And it doesn't necessarily have to be wholehearted participation. He at least has to say, yeah, I'm not going to tell people no. You know, I think it would be fine. There are, as I mentioned this morning, there are lots and lots and lots of things that people can do that have nothing to do with dealing with a dead body. Just think about it. There are flowers. There's a mercy meal. There's contacting, especially in a tragic death or an emergency, contacting relatives, contacting friends, putting the obituary together, getting it done, maybe picking up family at the airport, at the train station, at the bus station. You know, or there's a lot of things that people can do to contribute to this ministry without ever having to touch a dead body. And remember, it only takes two people to prepare a body. One person can do it, but it's not safe. I don't recommend it. I think with my experience, I could probably manage it. It depends on a lot of things, not to mention the size of the body. But are there any healthcare workers in here? Nurses? Yeah. So you've had training in body mechanics and how to move a body around. It's not that simple, and you need to know. We're going to talk about that as we go this afternoon. But you need two people to do this. Yes?
So, Deacon Mark, would it be optimal to have a team of four for each parish, so two guys and two gals?
Absolutely.
Depending on...
Yes.
Right.
That's at least that. And you need a reader, so it takes three people in the room. You don't have to have a reader. In fact, in the book we say if you don't have a reader... you can. There's actually a service in the book. I searched. I don't read Greek. You know, I don't. There may be a service out there for the preparation of a body for burial. I can't. It's hard for me to believe we don't have one, but I've never seen it. So we got together with our priests.
Just the reading of the Psalter.
It's the reading of the Psalter. Yeah. It's a typical Orthodox service that has prayers, reading of the Psalter, the Epistle, the Gospel. And more prayers and readings. So what we did was try to choose psalms that are particularly helpful at this time. They all are. There's no question about it. But ones that will give some solace to the bereaved as well as whatever help they can give to the deceased. I mean, who knows? But we know that the reading of Scripture, and particularly the Psalms, is beneficial at all times. But the reading of the Psalter is prescribed for this time. Mm-hmm. From the moment of death until the beginning of the funeral, we read the book of Psalms over the body. Mm-hmm. So we know it has some beneficial effect that we don't know about.
With periodic trisagion, memorial service.
Exactly. The only stop for services. So two people and a reader. Again, 10 years of experience. You may find this strange, but I really recommend that you limit the number of people in the room to five. Now, why would you have more than five? What? We had a beloved parishioner pass away, subdeacon. He died at 3 o'clock in the morning, as always expected, and we got the call. When we arrived at his house, there were at least 20 people there at 3 o'clock in the morning on John's Island. And every single one of them wanted to be in the room and put their hands on him and help. It became a management job. Father John and I met there, and we were ready to prepare the body for burial, and we ended up just managing people. Okay, you read, it's line up here, it's one reader after another, and then you can come over here. And so limit the number of people in the room to five, if at all possible. I mean, you don't want to reject people, you know, it's a pastoral issue. But it became very difficult. So five is pretty much an optimum number. I mentioned consider maintaining the parishioner's files at the church, copies, not the originals. Also, remember that at the time of death, safe deposit boxes are sealed. Do not keep any of these important papers in the safe deposit box. They're sealed until after probate. You can't get to them from the moment of death. So pull them out, put them in a safe place, have a safe at home or somewhere else. But of course, your executor or your power of attorney is going to be responsible for the originals anyway. Research cemeteries and funeral homes. There is nothing to prevent you, and we strongly encourage churches to band together to raise funds to establish an Orthodox cemetery if you don't already have one. I can't tell you how important that really is. We don't think about it much, but it really is important for us to have our own consecrated ground that we control where we can bury people. It doesn't take a lot of land. Believe it or not, 1 acre of ground will yield 500 graves. Cemetery is a very lucrative business.
One acre for 500 graves.
It blew my mind. We were working with a church up in Indiana who had a perfect flat 1 acre, and I asked Father Alexis, you know, how many graves can you get? 500. So, church our size, going to take generations to fill that up. You don't need that. You don't need that much. But you could have several churches go together and have a couple of acres of ground somewhere not too far away and establish a cemetery. Yes, Father?
So, in the old country where they have the above-the-ground
The ossuary?
Yeah. Is that illegal in the U.S., or why isn't that?
I don't think so, and I'm a huge advocate for the ossuary. I would love to have a cemetery with an ossuary in it. And that's another thing I wanted to mention, that we don't need a lot of land because we recycle. We reuse the graves. And in any bylaws or any organizational documents, and any time someone would sign a contract to be buried in our cemetery, I would have that document state that they understand at some point they're going to be dug up and their bones will be stored in the ossuary. Anyone who's been to a monastery that has an ossuary, who's ever seen one, has ever visited one, knows what an awesome thing it is. And St. John Chrysostom told his people, go and pray in the cemetery. Tomorrow that is you. Don't forget, that's you tomorrow. And that's why the monasteries do this. I was on Athos in September. Thanks be to God, I was able to finally get there and visited a couple of ossuaries at different monasteries. And it's very, very powerful thing. It's a wonderful thing. And we really need to do that. It's a constant, in-your-face reminder that tomorrow this is you. It's very hard to be there and not have that feeling. What have I forgotten about organizing and putting it together?
Would you say it's also a good alternative to actually, like, if there's a monastery that you frequent, to maybe approach the abbess or abbot and ask if you can be buried there? Is that also?
Absolutely. That's what we do.
We have a headstone.
We have a 2-acre plot of land that was donated to us. It's about an hour and a half away. But most people still, we haven't used it yet. Most people, still elect to be buried at Saints Mary and Martha Monastery, which is 2 hours away. And I personally don't think 2 hours is too far to travel to bury a brother or sister. I really don't. I just don't think that's too far, too much to ask. Not everyone can do it every time, but, you know, it I don't think it's too much.
2 hours is down the street for us.
Yeah, I learned that yesterday. Yeah. 3 hours to the airport. Yeah.
We actually have a headstone at St. Mary and Martha says Barna, so the kids don't even have to get that.
Yeah.
So it's a big plot. His mom and dad are already just all in there together.
Mm-hmm. I have a question to have about my parish, and perhaps you priests maybe would find help in this. We're at the point, and you're here, actually, as a key element in our... We've already been at work on many of these fronts that you mentioned, but we're... Some of our lay men and women who are definitely taking the initiative in this, with my blessing, are in the work of organizing a burial society ministry, you know, a ministry of doing exactly what you're talking about. Could you address us then to help us with our thinking? Like, first things first. Thank you. First things first. Like, check, check, check. Like, I know your book's got a lot of details in it, but now I'm speaking about a parish ministry. Like, what are things that we can just sort of like say, okay, we need to get this in place, that in place, blah, blah, blah.
Everybody asks that. They're surprised to learn that after 10 years, our burial society consists of me, Elizabeth, and Father John. We do have it. That's sort of a joke. We have people who are ready to help at any time. This is not something you do every week. This is not something you do every month. You may not have a funeral for 3 or 4 years.
Okay, we have not had a funeral in this church since Theodore Green. Okay.
And that was done by the military.
We're a young parish. We haven't, but I look over my parish and I see people who are getting older by the day, and some of them are really getting old.
And it's not a matter of age.
And then it's going to be a deal where when it rains, it snows.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't want to come up to that last day and not be ready. I don't want to be called in any funeral parlor.
No. I'm trying. That's really what I'm trying to do
now. And that's
what
I'm asking.
Is understand state law. It's really a first step.
Okay.
You don't have to have any sort of... We don't have a charter. We don't have any organization. Someone dies. Father calls me. I call somebody else. Elizabeth and I, we have the kit. It's ready. That's the number one thing. Have everything available. I can pick up that airport carry-on, throw it in the car, stop at the grocery store on the way to the house to get some dry ice, and we're there. We're doing it. People, we love to overcomplicate things that are actually very, very simple and very easy to do. But really, the very first step, understand your state law. Understand if you need help, there's bound to be an Orthodox attorney somewhere in L.A. that might be willing to help us for free. But anyone can read law. Just read it. If there's something you don't understand about it, then talk to an attorney about it. But you can certainly read it. I read every statute and every regulation in South Carolina. And when I got to the very last sentence of all of those statutes and regulations, it said, these regulations do not apply to home funerals and church burials. So there are no regulations in South Carolina on family funerals and church burials. It's really... And you think about it, you go, like I said, we're so used to everything being illegal. You know, there's a law against everything that we don't even think about. This is so unregulated that, you know, anyone can do it. And why not? We've been doing it forever. As long as there have been human beings, we've been burying our own dead. We don't need professionals for this.
Right.
Yes, Father.
The two hangups that I've witnessed and for the two funerals that I've done here in California are, one, getting that signature from the doctor, which for some reason, even from the mortuary, took several days. At the earliest I've seen so far from the two were 4 days. The other thing was scheduling the burial of when the cemetery was available to receive the body.
Yeah. Really?
And so I don't know what's going on here. I don't know if that's just my area or if that's a California thing, but
most California cemeteries are closed on Saturday and Sunday. Holidays, Monday holidays, Fridays, and so it's tough.
We are very fortunate that as Christians, we don't have the very strict timetables that the Muslims and Jews have.
Right.
But this is another really good reason to have our own cemetery, that we can use it whenever we need to.
Okay, number one, Cal State laws. Number two?
Have a kit. Put a kit together.
Get your kit together.
It's very important that, as Father was talking about earlier, that you know where to file that paperwork, where you have to go, what you have to do. And we have found, too, that things differ from county to county.
Yes.
Would you tell them about Peter and how that was
the next step? Talk to your county coroner. Call him up. I don't know what LA's like, but she was extremely helpful to me.
In what way?
She spent about an hour on the phone with me talking about this and that and this and that. Telling, you know, my question was, well, it also helped that I told her I had three parents living with me. What happens if one of them dies? I need to know what's the procedures. What do I do? So when people hear that, they're usually very helpful, at least in the South. I don't know what they're like. No, California is not, even Southern California is not the South. Just like Florida is not the South. You just have to go through the South to get to it. Yes, sir.
I think you sort of touched on this. What do you do, and have that experience, where maybe either the children or the parents aren't Orthodox? It seems like you'd have to bring them into this process before you sort of go, oh, by the way, we're not going to a funeral home, we're going to do this. And either the kids aren't Orthodox in a way, we don't like that, or objects.
Well, that's a pastoral matter, but it's also a matter that's handled by taking care of your paperwork. Get your paperwork in order.
They might be Orthodox by the end of it.
Amen. And get a copy to the parents. It would be my responsibility, not yours, to get a copy to my parents, to my siblings, so that the people in my life who matter know what it is that I want and they know what to expect. I had a good friend of ours was ill and was expected to die at some point. And I got a call one afternoon from a beautiful young lady who said, is this Deacon Mark? She said, is this Mark Barton? I said, yes. She said, Deacon Mark? I said, yes. She said, my father is Tom Herbert. We knew him as Peter. We always talked of him as Peter. And she said, my grandfather said, when I die, call Deacon Mark. He knows what to do.
Ooh.
What does that mean?
Puts it all on you.
So I told her what that meant. I said, here's what we'll do. So the way we would normally handle it with family who is not aware, and you have the papers there to back it up because the paperwork is done, this is what your loved one wanted. This is what we're prepared to do. We're prepared to handle everything. You don't have to do a thing. But be there. But we welcome you to be with us, to observe, so that, you know, it goes without saying, so you know we're not doing something weird with your loved one's body. surprisingly to us, the universal reaction has been, watch, heck, I want to help. And the family gets involved.
Yeah.
This same young lady, when Peter died, petite little rancher from Montana, beautiful girl.
Hmm? Cowgirl?
She's cowgirl. She's a rancher from Montana. And his grandson, who is a Marine. So we're standing in the alley outside the Medical University morgue. They're always in the alley. And we were just standing out there getting ready to go in, and these two young people walk up. I've never met them. I wasn't expecting them. And they walk up and say, "Are you Deacon Mark?" "Yes." "Well, we are who we are. Our mom told us to come down here and see you. What are we going to do?" "Okay. Well, your granddad has died. We're going to prepare him for burial." "Well, what does that mean?" "Well, imagine for a minute that you have been called to greet the king. What will you do?" "You'll bathe, wash your hair, put on clean clothes, probably do your nails. You might even get a hairdo. I don't know. But you're going to prepare yourself. You're going to put on your best clothes. You're going to prepare to greet the king. Your grandfather has been called to greet the king. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to do all that for him." "Oh, great." So we went into the morgue and they just did it. It was wonderful. They loved their grandpa. They loved him a lot. He loved them. And it was the greatest honor that they could show him, that they were willing to do that without question. "Yeah, what are we going to do?" "Well, we're going to go in and touch a dead body, if you don't mind." And there's a lot more to that story, but it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And that's typical of people when we say, this is what... Another typical reaction is, "You can do that? You can do that? Yes, yes." And that's what we've done it before. We're going to do it again. We're going to do it for your mom, for your dad. We're going to do it right now.
That I want you to talk about?
Yes.
Because you mentioned that Peter was at the morgue. You know, you can keep a body at home if you have nowhere to prepare. We have a good relationship with the morgue director. Sometimes we use a funeral home just for the refrigeration if it's going to be a long time.
Right.
So there's a lot of different options there. So just if you're wondering why we were doing him at the morgue, that's just
That's another part, and we can talk about that right now. Julius Fielding is actually mentioned in the dedication of the book. He's the fellow who this morning said, "We've had Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists in here. You're the first Christians." He became a very good friend. I've learned an awful lot from him because we were the first Christians. And he's a Christian. And he's like, "Oh, it's about time.
Yeah.
Why don't Christians do this?" They really hadn't thought about it.
Right.
But when he saw Christians doing it, he just fell in love with us. He said, "I knew there was something I like about you."
Is this the morgue, like the county morgue?
No, this is the Medical University morgue.
Medical University.
Yes. Talk to your coroner. The most likely the only time a body is going to go to the medical examiner is for an autopsy. You're probably not going to need to do that. But if you have multiple jurisdictions, you need to talk to each of those coroners, and we learned that with Peter. I knew where Peter lived. I visited him. We were there many times. I knew he lived in Berkeley County, not Charleston County. Yeah, well, yeah, that's another story.
Yeah.
But it just, I completely blew it. I just never thought that I should call the Berkeley County coroner. We knew he was going to die. I just completely blew it. So Peter died around midnight on a Saturday night. And we needed to get the paperwork done. We needed to get a death certificate, get the burial, removal, and transportation permit, and take his body to be for preparation. We did an initial preparation, as I describe in the book. We did it there in his bed, but we needed to get him to the church where we could finish it. And that's when it occurred to me, oh, we're in Berkeley County. We have to call the Berkeley County coroner. Okay, it's midnight on Saturday night. Who's on duty in the coroner's office? The low man on the totem pole. It ain't the coroner. It's the new guy. He wasn't about to release that body to anybody. He'd never heard of us. What are you talking about? Oh, my goodness. So we called the Medical University morgue. And lo and behold, thanks be to God, Julius Fielding answered the phone. Now, he's the director of the Medical University morgue. What's he doing there at midnight on Saturday night? But he was there. He talked with Father John, and he said, don't worry, I'll call you back in a few minutes. He called back in about 10 minutes and said, don't worry about a thing. The Berkeley County coroner is going to release the body to me. I've arranged for a transport company to bring the body to MUSC morgue. You guys come over here tomorrow and prepare his body. So all of it worked out, even though I blew it. That brings up another important thing to know. When funeral directors need to pick up a body, they don't go get it themselves. This was news to me. There are companies out there that are transport companies. They are contracted by the funeral director to go pick up a body. And instead of it costing $1,500, that is the, I mentioned the basic services fee. If all you want the funeral director to do is go pick up a body and bring it to the church, $1,500 plus the cost of the hearse, plus the cost of the driver. But they will charge you that $1,500. So instead of $1,500 plus, it was $150 to get him transferred to MUSC morgue. And that we could handle, no problem. So that's an important thing to know. If you can do some research on that and find out about a transport company, that I'm sure they have them out here.
If a person dies at home in bed of natural causes, don't you have to call paramedics?
It depends, and that's something you need to talk to your coroner about. It's one of the things that I asked my coroner, and one of the reasons we were on the phone so long. I said, okay, I have three parents living here in my home. They're under hospice care. What happens if one of them dies? She said, well, hospice will come out, and the hospice doctor will pronounce death. And she said, you can call 911. Tell them it is not an emergency. It's an expected death. The police will come out. They will do an initial investigation. They'll see the DNR on the door. They'll see all the medical equipment. They'll
DNR,
see every,
do not resuscitate.
Yeah, DNR, do not resuscitate. It's right there on the door. They'll see the situation, and that will probably be the end of it. And then you can call the funeral director, or you can fill out the paperwork. In reality, what happened was much simpler, as I described this morning. The hospice nurse, these folks who have dealt with death as a profession, as hospice people do, are very adept at seeing the signs of the death process. And they will say, today's the day. And you can gather everybody together. Today's the day. When my mother died, the hospice doctor didn't even come out. The hospice nurse notified the doctor that she was dead, and they brought the death certificate to the house. That's all it took. The doctor signed the death certificate.
If they're not in hospice, and this might be a question for everybody, if they're not in hospice, how do they get the death certificate?
Well, from the doctor. In our state, it is the doctor who supplies the death certificate because he has to put on there the time of death, the cause of death, and sign it.
What doctor? The doctor for the person that's died.
It will be the family doctor. In fact, I think California law, I've got it right here, says family doctor. If they die in the hospital, it'll be a doctor at the hospital, and the death certificate will go with the person down to the morgue. If it's someone who dies at home and they're not in hospice care, it'll be the family doctor.
Mm-hmm. My father died at home. My mother was caring for him. His death was imminent, and when he did indeed die, the only thing that we needed to do was notify the doctor, and he signed the death certificate because mm-hmm. he knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. And that was very simple, so he didn't go into the system. There was an issue of autopsy and to find cause of death and talk to the family doctor who said, no, we know how he died. He does not need to have an autopsy.
Yep.
So it was really that simple because he had that doctor's care all along.
Right.
So that's my...
So you understand what a death certificate really is in our state. It's called a vital records form. And it's the doctor puts time of death, cause of death, and signs it. And the rest of it, the family fills out, saying the age of the person, the sex of the person, what their occupation was. It's all demographic data that goes to the Department of Vital Records. They file it. They enter it into their computers. And if you ever wondered where the CDC gets all this data that they put on how people die and why they die and where they die, that's where it comes from. It comes from death certificates. It's a vital records form, and in that regard has not a whole lot to do with the dead person, I mean, with the death itself. But you do need it to prove that the person is dead. So when you take that form to the vital records, or let's see, what is it called here? The local registrar at the county health department is what happens in California. You need to get copies of it. You need probably a dozen copies, certified copies. They don't give you a Xerox copy. And some of the things you're going to need a death certificate for, they'll accept a simple Xerox copy. Others, like insurance and other things, require a certified death certificate. So to really take care of business and closing the estate, you need certified death certificates. So get 10 or a dozen of them, probably. It depends on who the person is. I'm still trying to answer your question, Father. Are we doing any good?
So far, I got Cal State laws. What are they?
Yep. Talk to your coroner. Talk
for help on ID, these things.
Yep.
Two, get your kit together. Quote, Christina. Three, get L.A. coroner talk, L.A. County coroner, or in L.A. County. What do you have to do when someone dies at home? What is a subset of that question?
Yes.
Then I wrote, get parish file, e-file started. People who are interested in having records kept in a parish level. And then I wrote five, research transport, and that's all as far as I got.
Great.
Didn't see anything about having trained people. When you,
what does that mean?
Do you have kids?
I have four children.
You've watched a baby?
They're all adults.
You wash the baby? You're trained. Everybody wants to know about training. Everybody wants to. If you have washed a baby, you can do this. Babies are a lot more fragile than dead bodies. They're just bigger. It's the simplest, most natural thing that we do. When it's not a, and we're going to give you all the training you need this afternoon. We're going to actually talk about what does it take to prepare a body. But let me, can you help me with Father, getting him what he needs? Do you have parishioners who are not in L.A. County?
Yes.
Okay.
We have three counties.
Someone needs.
L.A., Riverside, San Bernardino.
So do we. We have three counties as well. So,
or Orange County, we have four counties.
You may ask someone who lives in that county to do this for you. Call your county coroner, and just hopefully have a chat. I don't know, they may be really busy and not want to talk with you, but you know, I'm with St. Peter's Church. We're forming a burial ministry. We are Orthodox Christians. Our burial tradition is very much the same as the Jews. And I would like to talk with you about your protocols and what we need to know about your procedures when one of our parishioners dies at home in your county. And see if you can start that conversation. If you can make an appointment and go down and sit with them, it's great. This all happened over the phone with my coroner, and it was going so well. I said, well, thanks. That's really great. That's a lot of information. Can I ask you another question? I'm out cleaning the gutters, and I fall off the ladder and break my neck. What do we do? And she just walked me through everything. So she was just very, very helpful. Excellent. Don't be afraid to call the coroner.
So what if in our county a parishioner doesn't die at home but dies at a facility? Mm-hmm. They get elderly care facility, for example.
Right.
Or the hospital.
Do we make arrangements with that facility first, or is it the same thing through the county?
You have taken their paperwork. They have that person's last directives rather than last wishes. We call them wishes, but we know their directives. They have their paperwork on file in that facility, whether it's a nursing home, assisted living, or a hospice. They have it on file. And you've already talked with them. They already know that you're coming. Besides, you've been there. You got somebody in hospice, you're there. You're there like every day. So they know by now, they know what to expect. And usually, again, in the South, we still live with Christians. They're everywhere. It's like crazy. Everybody's a Christian.
There's 7,000 that haven't been in the bail here.
And they're, by and large, really, really impressed that we would even talk with them about these things, much less that we would want to do this. And they're very accommodating, extremely accommodating. It can be a great evangelical ministry besides what we're doing. We've gotten at least one convert from a funeral that we did.
We have prepared, I'm sorry.
Generally very accommodating. You can prepare the body right there in the room. It can be done in a hospital if they know what to expect and they're not so busy they got to have the bed. You can do it in the hospital morgue. You can do it at the hospice. We've prepared many people in their own bed at home, which is kind of optimum. That's where they want to die, and why would we do anything but prepare them right there? And the family can be there, and the family can help, and they're right at home. The subdeacon I talked about, we held vigil there, and he was there for, I think, a couple of days on refrigeration in his bed. And his wife, to this day, just is gushing in praise for all of this. She's one of our biggest fans, that his grandchildren, who were really quite small, were able to come in and talk to him, say goodbye to him more than once, bring him flowers. Yeah. It was just, you know, and the public at large is like, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
Little children? You're going to expose little children to a dead body? Well, of course, it's their grandfather. And they had all this time to say goodbye and become accustomed to the idea that he's dead.
We'll do a little plug. His psalms are the psalms that we have in
yes.
our book.
It's, yes.
What is the name of
Donald
book?
Sheehan. I don't know. It's in here.
His son is.
I have to look it up. But the service that we use, that we created for this purpose, is in the book, and it's all psalm readings. And he was the head of the Robert Frost Center at Dartmouth College for many, many, many years, and he translated the psalms, and his son, his wife, gave us permission to use his psalm. So that's what's in the book.
How do you do refrigeration at home?
Dry ice.
Okay.
drive. It's a very, very simple process. We will talk about that as we go. Yes, ma'am.
Protocols and regulations with the county and coroner's offices and things like that, do those tend to be different when there's a minor that has died?
You will have to ask them. Okay. We had, that's one we have not run into ourselves. I don't think so.
Right.
Particularly if the parents are involved. Particularly if the parents are survivors,
right,
and are going to be the ones giving their permission and directing things. It will obviously, that would be a tortuous situation for them to have to bury a child. I mean, even burying an adult child is a terrible, terrible thing. Let me talk for a moment about California law. A really good resource is the Funeral Consumers Alliance. These people, for some strange reason, have dedicated themselves to straightening out the funeral industry.
Wow.
They are really, and well, not so much straightening out the funeral industry as kind of getting around it, doing away with it. They're the big proponents of home-directed funerals. Understand they are a secular group, so they are very, everything they talk about, there's a lot of talk of cremation on their website, in their book and whatnot, but they have sort of a compendium, a digest of all 50 states and what their laws are. Someone asked this morning, or was it last night, someone asked of the line of succession of people who have the control to make decisions about a body. First in line is the person with a health care power of attorney who also has been given the right and duty of disposition. So it can be two different people. The health care power of attorney doesn't have to be the death care power of attorney, okay? Or it can be the same person, it's as you wish. Number two is a competent surviving spouse. That was the question last night. Number three is the sole surviving competent adult child of the decedent. And under that same one is, or the majority of the surviving competent adult children. Does anyone in here hear the implications of that?
Yes.
They're going to take a vote. Do your paperwork. This is the worst, one of the worst things that can happen. Siblings will fight over mom and dad's remains, and there's nothing you can do about it except tell them in writing, this is the way I want it, and appoint someone to do that, whether it's one of your children or your priest or whoever you want it to be. One of the first things I said this morning, it can cause strife in the family, and it will cause unnecessary stress to your loved ones if you don't give them direction, if you don't tell them, this is what I want. One sibling says, well, mom told me she wanted to be cremated, and the other one says, she's Orthodox, she can't be cremated. And it's something you don't need. You do not need that. Number four is the surviving competent parent. Number five, sole surviving competent adult sibling. And then number six is the next degree of kinship and on down, depending on who survives. Family can get a blank death certificate from the local health department if they'll give it to you. Again, I said, as I mentioned this morning, some jurisdictions don't like to have death certificates floating around out there. They keep them kind of close. California, like many states, has gone to electronic filing of death certificates. I'm still not clear on how you would then get the burial, removal, and transport permit. You go to the jurisdiction, you file the death certificate, and then they give you a certificate that allows you to transport the body. I think professionals are sort of exempt from the BRT. They have to have one at some point. Because it has to be on file at the final resting place, the place of final disposition. If it's a monastery, they keep a file of BRTs. If it's a cemetery, they have a file of every person who's buried out there. The BRT is actually a good form. You know, no one likes bureaucratic forms, but it's a good form. This is the form that if you're transporting a body from the hospital to the church, you get in an accident or you get stopped by the police for a taillight being out, this is the form that tells the policeman, I'm okay. I am authorized to have a dead body in my car. Okay, so this you want to have this, and you don't want to transport the body without it. Obviously, professionals may have additional latitude that we don't have, but you really want to have that form if you're going to transport a body. Transporting a body. The local registrar and the county health department will issue a permit for disposition. One copy must be filed with the registrar in the county of disposition, that's wherever the grave is, and one must be returned to the issuing registrar within 10 days. They always give you a lot of time, and I've never understood. You have like 4 or 5 days to file the death certificate, but you have to have the death certificate to transport the body, so you usually want to get it filed pretty quickly if you can. You might find this interesting. Body burial must have 18 inches of earth on top. 18 inches of earth. I still have not figured out where the 6 foot under came from. I haven't read it anywhere. I don't know where that started. In South Carolina, you must have 12 inches of earth on top of the container. That's assuming there is a container, a casket. If you're buried in the ground and there's no container, you can have 12 inches of dirt. Unless burial is in the low country of South Carolina, and then the container can be equal with the top of the earth. That's because of tides.
We buried a guy in our church in Idaho, and we did it the organic way. We buried him. They dug. We had them dig the hole for us at the cemetery, and then we filled it in. They dug it deep. And we lowered that casket. It went down a long way. So maybe
they wanted to make sure he was dead.
It was the old Western 6 feet under. I mean, there was a lot of work to cover that group.
The reason we have that
stuff. Another theory is the stack of
that's
in the cemetery.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's been done
six
for
6 feet down. You could put two feet down.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was about.
Well, that's covered here, too. I didn't go into that, but it says, with a double-depth burial, one vault on top of another at least 12 inches should cover the top. And in Old England, they used to stack them in the grave. In the low country of South Carolina, if you dig down 18 to 24 inches, you got water. So we don't go very deep there. And that's one of the reasons, like in New Orleans, you see a lot of crypt burials above the ground because they're below the water table there. Local municipalities have the jurisdiction over cemetery matters in California. So if you want to establish a cemetery, you need to talk with the local authority, which I assume would be the town, or it says municipalities. In a rural area, it might be the county. We were working with a church up in Pennsylvania, and they ran into a situation where they wanted to establish a cemetery. So they did the right thing, and they went down to the county offices, and they wanted to register their cemetery. And the county had no idea what to do. No one had established a cemetery in that county in over 100 years. And they didn't know what process they should follow. They worked through it, but it was an interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something you do every day, establishing a cemetery, but you can, yes.
Can you bury somebody in your backyard if the county said so, you could?
Of course.
If the
county says you can.
You live in a neighborhood, probably not.
But they're not.
If you're rural, yes.
But they're not going to. That's the point. In your local municipality, your town is not going to say, yeah, it's okay, bury your grandma in your backyard. It's not going to happen. But theoretically, yes, you could. If you want to establish a family cemetery, draw a map of the property showing where the burial ground will be and take it to the local zoning board and tell them we want to establish a cemetery for our church. It's not an outrageous request, and it will probably be granted if certain things are in line, such as it's not near a water supply and it's not right under a power line or something like that. You can't probably get approved.
So we could, in theory, maybe even have a cemetery right here on our property?
Yeah, so I'm writing it down.
You could. You could establish one here if it meets whatever criteria.
Because the petition says for all of those who here and everywhere lie in asleep in the Lord. Who here and everywhere. Here. Mm-hmm. Where's the here? It's assuming a church cemetery.
Regulations and not statutes. Understand that the legislature writes statutes, and generally we have gotten away from a statutory form of government in America, and we've gone to a regulatory form of government. The legislature writes a statute, and generally in situations like this, the only thing the statute does is establish an authority who then has the authority to promulgate regulations. Why would we want to do that? Well, if you have a complaint against the regulating authority, you go to your legislature and he says, I don't have anything to do with it. That's the regulating board. Don't blame me. You have to talk to the regulators. And so we've really gotten away from our legislatures actually doing anything that has regulatory power. They give it all to some unelected bureaucrats to enforce and promulgate regulations. But the regulations, not statutes, require that a body be embalmed or refrigerated after 24 hours. If you go to a funeral director, he's going to tell you that body has to be embalmed or it has to be buried within 24 hours. That's because they know that it's going to take more than 24 hours for the family to gather and have a funeral. It usually takes around 3 days. But the regulation says that it must be embalmed or refrigerated within 24 hours. That means you got 24 hours to get it on ice. It doesn't say anything about how long it can be on ice, because you can hire the funeral home, or if you're good friends with your morgue director, he might keep the body a few more days if he has room. And they've done that for us several times. They said, Mark, you know we don't have a lot of room in the fridge. Yes, but we really need, can go one more day? And you can do those kind of things. Funeral directors are required, and you have to sign a form that you have to sign an authorization that discloses that embalming provides no permanent preservation. Okay, just what we said this morning. Embalming is a great big lie, but that language will probably be buried in some form that you're going to sign without reading it when you're arranging for a funeral. That you understand that it's not permanent. If the body is to be shipped by common carrier, it must be embalmed or shipped in an airtight container. Okay? It does not have to be embalmed to be shipped. And this is common carrier. This is not me putting my mother in the back of the van and carrying her down the road, which we have done many, many times. It's not disrespectful. It's ultimately respectful. I carried my own mother. I didn't hire some schmuck to come and do it for me. I carried her to her grave, carried her to her grave, put her in her grave, and filled it myself. It's ultimately respectful to do it that way. Some people, on the other hand, just want to have a hearse. They really do. On the very first time we put this information out for public consumption, one of our parishioners, a doctor, came up and said, there is no way you're carrying me to my grave in a pickup truck. I want a hearse. Fine. You can have a hearse. You can have all the flowers. You can have whatever you want. That's the whole point. The whole point of this is you can have what you want. Understand that if all you want is a hearse, you're going to pay $1,500 or whatever it is in L.A., plus the cost of the hearse, plus the driver. You can have whatever you want, just be prepared to pay for it. I'm not going to argue with any family member or anyone. The whole idea is to respect the wishes of the deceased and to respect the bereaved family. We're not here to cause trouble. We're here to do the very best we can for everyone. One of the, let's see,